reaching up to take his hand. She gripped it hard, as if he were being pulled away from her. She saw Chris and John and Sal kneeling beside her suddenly, all of them smiling as John said, "Thank God," and Sal said, "Amen," and Chris just grinned so broadly that he looked as if he might burst into laughter at any moment. "You're back," Chris said finally.
"Yeah, I guess so,"
Carmen whispered. Nearly 2 hours later, Carmen was sleeping restlessly beside Al on the mattress. Chris, John, and Sal were talking softly over coffee in the dining room. Al was propped up on his side in pajama bottoms and a robe, watching Carmen as she slept. His forehead was creased with worry, fear, and confusion. Carmen tossed back and forth as she slept, her sleeping eyes pressed together beneath a dark frown. He prayed silently, never taking his eyes from her, relieved that Laura and the kids weren't around to see what had happened. And then, Carmen's body stiffened, and her back arched, as if she were in silent agony. Once again, her throat began to swell and darken, turning a purplish black. Al sat up, clutching her shoulder, calling, "It's happening again! Get out here! It's happening again! Oh, Jesus, Jesus Christ!" Footsteps rushed across the hall and into the living room, and the researchers hurried over the mattresses to Al and Carmen. John had a crucifix in his hand and held it out before him as he said loudly, with authority, "In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave this place." Chris and Sal quickly joined in, saying the words with him. Carmen's head tilted back, her eyes opened to reveal only glistening whites as she gurgled and choked, and her arms and legs began to shake and convulse violently. Al shot to his feet suddenly, fists at his sides, teeth clenched, and growled furiously, "God damn it! I'm stronger than she is! Come to me, you son of a bitch! Do it to me!" All three men fell silent at once and turned to Al. Chris shouted, "Al, don't say that!" And Sal grabbed Al's arm and barked, "Stop!" as John dropped to his knees at Carmen's feet and continued the invocation alone, nearly shouting now, still holding the cross out toward Carmen as if it were a weapon. But Al ignored them. "Come to me, damn it," he continued. "I'll fight you, you goddamned son of a bitch, you fucking—" Al's words caught in his throat, as sharply and suddenly as fish bones, lodging there as he began to make a strangled gurgling sound. His eyes grew wider and wider, the color drained from his face, leaving him a sick, pale color. Then he was thrown down to the mattress, as if by powerful but invisible arms, and he landed with a strangled grunt. "Oh, dear God," Sal groaned. Al landed on his hands and knees, head falling forward, weakly. Carmen's erratic movements began to calm down. The swelling and blackening of her throat began to go away, as Al's condition seemed to worsen. John continued to invoke the name of Christ at a fever pitch, his forehead sparkling with beads of perspiration. As Chris and Sal watched, the hem of Al's bathrobe was thrown hard up over his head, and the elastic waistband of his pajama bottoms was torn as they were pulled down violently, revealing his bare behind. Al screamed, his voice so high and shrill it sounded like a woman's, and his whole body began to jerk, as if something were ramming into it, again and again and again. His screams continued, screams filled with pain, with horror. Carmen began to stir. She opened her eyes and blinked several times as she sat up.
"What's wrong?" she asked, turning to Al. "Oh my God, what's happening to him?"
John stopped the invocation and took a long breath. Then, his voice hoarse, he said,
"He's being attacked, like you were, just a few seconds ago."
For a long moment, they all watched Al, stunned and helpless, knowing exactly what was happening to him.
"Oh, God,"
Carmen gasped, beginning to cry. She moved toward Al and put an arm around his shoulders as he continued to scream shrilly again and again, a sound that was so foreign to Carmen coming from her muscular, rock-ribbed husband. She looked over her shoulder and shouted at the others,
"Do something! That's what you're here for, damn it! Do something!"
But their prayers had no effect. When it was over, Carmen huddled beside him and held him close.
"Oh my God, honey, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry you had to go through that."
Having experienced the same thing herself, Carmen knew exactly how humiliating it was, how helpless she'd felt while she was being violated. It made her heart ache to know that Al had been through the same humiliating experience. Another night had passed in a house that had somehow developed a pipeline to hell. Al and Carmen and Laura were not the only ones to be attacked by the entity that had targeted their house, though for some reason it showed little interest in the smaller children. During their stay, all three researchers were assaulted in one way or another. They were tormented in their sleep, as well as pinched and stung and slapped again and again throughout the day and night. Objects continued to move around the house, apparently by themselves, almost as if they had lives of their own. Early one evening, after Al had gotten home from work, everyone had dinner outside, picnic style. When they came in, Sal was the first to notice that something odd was happening in the living room. He called for the other researchers, and naturally, everyone else in the house followed them in. Each of the mattresses on the floor was breathing. The middle of each one bulged slowly, as if inhaling, then relaxed, leveling out. Ed and Lorraine dropped in frequently and stayed for a few hours, witnessing for themselves many of the incidents that the researchers had seen firsthand. They saw some of the attacks. They witnessed the objects that moved around the house. They smelled the odors and saw the flashes of movement just out of their line of sight, movement seemingly caused by nothing. During one of their visits, they heard a loud, metallic rattling sound that seemed to be coming from the master bedroom. Al was at work, the kids were outside, and Sal and John were resting in the living room. So Ed and Lorraine, Carmen, Laura, and Chris went down the hall hesitantly and into the bedroom. Carmen and Laura each held a rosary, while Ed and Chris were carrying crucifixes. In the bedroom, the sound was much louder, and beneath their feet the wooden floor was vibrating slightly. They all stopped just inside the room. Finally, Lorraine stepped forward and put her hand lightly on the footboard of the bed. "It's much worse here," she said quietly. "Where's it coming from?" Ed asked, moving through the room slowly. Lorraine lifted her right hand before her, as she had done during her first visit to the house, and closed her eyes. "Not in here," she whispered. "Somewhere else." "Oh, God," Carmen said. "It sounds like the pulley, the body lift downstairs. It's right below this room. In fact, it's right below the bed." Suddenly the sound made sense. The metallic rattling was the kind that might be made by a chain hoist, like the one in the cold, damp basement below. They filed through the door at the back end of the bedroom that led down into the basement. When they were halfway down the stairs, the rattling stopped abruptly. In the basement, they found the heavy chain swinging slightly, the links jingling very softly. It was not the last time that happened, nor the last of the many strange occurrences Ed and Lorraine would witness. During another visit, Lorraine was enveloped by another frightening vision, not unlike the one she'd had the first time she'd walked through the house. She was standing at the top of the stairs near the bathroom, looking down into the bedroom below, about to descend into the basement, the part of the house that the Snedekers now refused to enter, when it began. It was so vivid and unexpected that, for a moment, she wasn't even aware that it was a vision, until she realized that she couldn't move, that she was paralyzed. A man appeared at the bottom of the stairs. He did not step around the corner. He simply appeared, as if from the very air around him. He wore a filthy undershirt and a pair of baggy, too-long pants that had once been tan but were now so stained and soiled that they looked more brown than anything. The ragged hems bunched around his feet, which wore nothing but dirty white socks. His round, sagging belly pressed against the undershirt and hung over the waist of the pants, with faint shadow filling the massive indentation made by his navel. His hair was black and stringy and fell to his shoulders. On top he was going bald, and his pale scalp was visible through wisps of hair. Beneath his left arm was tucked a pair of brown work boots. With the stubby fingers of his fat hands, he was pulling up and fastening his filthy pants. His breath came in winded, wheezing gasps, as if he'd been exerting himself a great deal. The man looked up, and his watery, bloodshot eyes locked with Lorraine's, which were wide and frightened. He grinned, showing jagged, discolored teeth. His lips were fat and dry and cracked, and his glistening tongue slid out to moisten them as he began to make his slow way up the stairs. "Nice bodies," he said, his voice low and phlegmy, wet and guttural. "Nice, cold bodies. Cold, firm bodies." He took step after step, closer and closer. "Don't move when you touch 'em. Don't fight when you hold 'em or lick 'em." He laughed. Closer and closer, step after step. "In fact, you can do anything you fucking want to 'em." He chuckled as he reached the top of the stairs. He reached for Lorraine's hand, saying, "Come on, I'll show. You want, you can watch me. See? I'm ready again." He laughed as he let the boots drop from beneath his arm and reached down for his crotch. Lorraine lowered her eyes and watched as he grabbed the horrible bulge that had grown between his legs. The zipper of his pants was still open, and she caught a glimpse of what looked like lumpy, purplish flesh, discolored with what appeared to be dirt or maybe blood. Closing her eyes and pushing herself backward away from him, Lorraine cried out as her back slammed against the bathroom door. When she opened her eyes again, she was sitting on the floor and the man was gone. Ed was kneeling at her side, anxiously whispering, "Lorraine, what is it? What's wrong?"
Horrible things, Ed. Horrible things happened in this house."
"Necrophilia?" She nodded.
"I saw something. A man. He told me what he did. He wanted me to watch."
Once Lorraine had calmed down and was able to stand and talk coherently, they explained to the others what she had seen and what it meant.
"That sort of thing," Ed said. "Necrophilia. I mean, sex with dead bodies. The kind of thing that, according to what Lorraine saw, happened here at one time. Is evil. It draws demonic activity. The location of such things can become a target for demonic attention."
"It's not necessarily a definitive explanation," Lorraine said hoarsely, a glass of ice water in her hand, "but it certainly goes along with the vision I was shown when I first came here. I really believe that is what happened here, and I believe it's what brought about the trouble you're having now."
"So, what do we do?" Carmen asked quietly. "How can we stop it?"
Ed and Lorraine looked at one another, silent for a moment. They had no doubt that what was happening in the house was very, very real. They knew what the next step was, but they didn't know what the result of taking it would be, and were reluctant to raise the Snedeker's hopes.
"Next," Ed said, "we contact the church."
"We've already done that," Al said, a little angry. "It didn't get us anywhere."
"I know," Ed replied. "Now we're going to contact them. We'll tell them what we've found, what we've seen, and what we believe to be the problem. The only thing is, and I'm not saying this is going to happen, but..."
"What?" Al snapped impatiently.
"We might get the same response you did."
26. Attention from the church. He pressed the doorbell, then stepped back from the door and put on a smile, holding his black bag at his side. Carmen opened the door and his smile opened into a grin. He held out his hand and said,
"You must be Mrs. Snedeker. I'm Father George. I talked with the Warrens and they told me about your problem."
"Oh, Father, I'm so glad you're here," she said, her voice sounding a bit desperate as she welcomed him into the house.
He felt it immediately, a dark, oppressive aura that seemed to be everywhere. But he kept his smile on, not wanting to alarm Mrs. Snedeker.
"So, what did the Warrens tell you?"
Mrs. Snedeker asked as they stood in the hall.
"They said you had some very unpleasant supernatural activity taking place in your house, that they felt was demonic in nature, and that you needed the help of the church."
That wasn't all they'd said, but he didn't tell her that. There was a good deal he didn't tell her. He didn't tell her that, along with being a priest, he'd been schooled in demonology, and was just as familiar with the subject as the Warrens. He didn't tell her that, After what the Warrens had told him, he'd known immediately how urgently his help was needed in the Snedeker home. And of course, he didn't tell her that upon stepping into the house, he could feel just how bad, just how advanced the problem was, and that he knew it would only get worse without immediate spiritual attention. Carmen took him into the dining room and introduced him to Laura and Peter. She explained that the researchers, Chris and John, Sal had gone, were resting in the living room and needed some sleep. She made him some tea, then asked him what he'd like to do.
"Well, how about if I just go through the house, bless it, sprinkle holy water in each room, and see what I find? Then, if you don't mind, I'd like to come back in a day or so with another priest, and perhaps say a mass."
"That sounds fine," Carmen said. "Is there anything you need from me?"
"Absolutely nothing. You've been more than kind."
He gave her a big smile as he stood and leaned down for his bag on the floor.
"Do you mind if I just take myself through the house?"
"Oh, sure, that's fine," Carmen said a little nervous. "Go right ahead. But it's not the house it used to be. All the mattresses are in the living room so we can sleep together in there and—"
"Please don't feel you have to apologize or explain. I understand, really."
He gave them another smile and a nod, then left the dining room and started down the hall, opening his bag. As soon as he was out of their sight, his smile fell away. It had been an effort to maintain ever since entering the house. The air itself felt alive with malignancy. Carmen Snedeker and her niece Laura both showed the toll of living in such an atmosphere. They looked disheveled, puffy, depressed, and every movement was heavy and labored. Their eyes were bloodshot and watery, and their speech, even when anxious, was just slow and halting enough to give away their situation. He said a silent prayer for them as he went down the hall. Father George went into the bedroom first, then the bathroom, then partway through the hall again, sprinkling holy water and blessing each room, each section of the house, then to the stairs. He felt it even on the very top step, and prayed for strength as he made his way down, knowing that something evil awaited him in the basement. The Warrens had warned him. But as he neared the bottom step, he realized their warning had not been strong enough. Something was gripping his stomach, twisting until he felt he might soon vomit. Finally, he stood at the bottom of the stairs and slowly, with hands trembling slightly, went about blessing the first room, then the next, where the feeling was even stronger. The corridor seemed stronger still, darker, almost smothering. He continued blessing each room in the basement until he realized he was crying, and had been for some time, his cheeks wet with tears. He stood in the room that had once been a morgue, surrounded by walls once stained with the blood of the dead, and went through the blessing, his words finally crumbling into babbles as he realized that something was happening. Something dark and yet transparent. A shapeless mass that moved fluidly, flowed and waved as it oozed out of the far wall and advanced toward Father George. He sprinkled more holy water and held up a crucifix as he backed out of the room, stumbling into the next room, and then he turned and crossed the corridor and hurried up the stairs. As he stood facing the bathroom, he paused to catch his breath, to calm down and wipe the tears from his cheeks with the hanky from his back pocket, praying to God to help him hide his fear from Carmen Snedeker and the others, who had already been through what was clearly more than enough. He went into the living room, where the researchers were sleeping, blessed it quietly, then moved carefully over the mattresses to get to the other bedrooms. When he was done, he returned to the dining room and smiled at Carmen and Laura.
"If it's okay with you, I would definitely like to return as soon as possible with another priest to celebrate the Mass. Perhaps tonight or tomorrow morning."
"Sure," Carmen said hoarsely. "But why'd you change your mind? Is something wrong?"
"Oh, no, I've just been thinking about my schedule, is all. Thank you for your patience and hospitality. I really should be going now."
Carmen stood and followed him to the door, then whispered,
"Do you think everything's going to be all right, Father? I mean, are we going to be all right?"
He gave her his best, most comforting smile, and put a hand gently on her shoulder, saying, "All things work together for good to them that love God." Carmen smiled then, looking as if that had made her feel better. The priest opened the door and said,
"I'll see you again soon."
He started down the sidewalk, and when he heard the front door close, he was surprised to find himself still trembling from the assault his senses had undergone inside the Snedeker household. Father George returned that very evening with another priest, who identified himself as Father Gary. Al met them at the door, shook their hands as he introduced himself, and led them into the living room. Everyone was there, Carmen and the three children, Laura and the two remaining researchers, Chris and John. As they stood just inside the living room doorway, Father George introduced Father Gary to the family and said,
"We would like to conduct a mass this evening, if it's all right with all of you, of course."
No one objected. Michael reached over and turned off the television as everyone stood, some on mattresses, some on the floor.
"What would you like us to do?" Al asked.
"Well, if we could have a table."
Father George turned and looked at the coffee table that had been pushed against the wall and out of the way of the mattresses.
"Oh, no problem,"
Al said, and John helped him move the table under the mattresses and in front of the two priests.
"Now," Father Gary said, sounding a bit shy, "if all of you could gather before us, if you don't mind standing on mattresses, that is."
"Oh, we're used to it by now," Chris chuckled.
They all did as the priest had asked. In a few moments, Father George and Father Gary began the Mass, delivering it in Latin. During the Mass, something began to happen. Something silent and very wrong. Something that should not have been happening during a Mass. Carmen and Laura were the first ones to notice it. They would not learn until later that they were the only ones to notice it. But they did see, simultaneously, the exact same thing. The shadowy cloud moved into the room, flowing liquidly and silently. First it oozed around Father George, then around Father Gary, until it held both of them in a diseased shadow. Although they let on to no one else what they were seeing, Carmen and Laura each felt their heartbeats speed up, their breathing grow short, and their throats become dry as they watched the undulating darkness surround the priests silently, mockingly, without the priests reacting at all. It was as if the entity were simply making fun of their harmless little ritual. In a little while, Laura began to feel something moving about her legs. She was wearing a pair of khaki hiking shorts and a white cotton blouse. She felt what seemed to be small hands on her bare legs, like the hands of a small child that wanted to be picked up. The tiny hands patted at her bare flesh, tugged at the hem of her shorts, their palms moist and cold, stubby fingers pleading with their movements.
"Pick me up, please. Carry me. Hold me. Please hold me close to you. Close to your little tits so I can suck them. So I can suck the fuckers dry, you cunt. You horny little cunt with your pussy lips so wet and your hole open so wide for something to—"
Laura flinched at the words that screamed through her mind as hot as fire, and her eyes blinked several times and began to water. She tried to focus her attention on the mass, tried hard. Tried not to cry out, which was her first impulse. The Mass continued without any interruption and, seemingly, without event. But as Laura was experiencing the tiny hands on her legs and the voice in her head, Carmen felt what seemed to be stiff fingers poking her all over her body, invisible fingers that continued to prod and poke relentlessly, as if a child were walking around and around her, a spoiled, angry child. A brat that wanted something it couldn't have and was angry. But Carmen did not move. She focused her attention on the mass and silently prayed for strength. And as Laura was being touched and spoken to, as Carmen was being poked and prodded by an invisible finger, Chris began to feel something too. It felt like a hand, and it was groping in the area of his crotch. At first it seemed to be on the outside of his pants, scraping the material around his zipper, as if trying to find its way in. Then, as if it needn't have done that in the first place, it eased through the material of his pants, through his undershorts, and he felt thin, ice-cold fingers wrap around his penis. At first, those fingers took turns applying pressure and rubbing just a bit, like the fingers of a lover trying to turn him on, trying to prime him for lovemaking. But these fingers were too bony, too cold, like the fingers of a corpse, a long-dead corpse. But the gentle movements soon gave way to harsh squeezing. The hand began to pull hard, too hard, until it became difficult for him to keep from crying out. But he managed somehow. He kept his attention on the mass and prayed silently, asking God for strength, until it finally stopped. For the next week, the Snedeker house was the center of what could only be described as an angry retaliation by the demonic forces that, until the mass had gone unchecked and had had free rein. Late one night, while Chris was sitting up at the dining room table, thumbing through a magazine and listening for any trouble that might arise, Laura's sleep was interrupted by what she at first thought to be a dream. She was shaken violently as her nightshirt was pulled up until the hem was gathered around her neck. Frighteningly, cold hands began to grope her breasts, to squeeze and knead roughly. Stick-like fingers pinched her, playfully at first, then harder and harder, until the pinching began to hurt, until it became terribly painful, until it became unbearable, and Laura tried to scream, hoping the nightmare would end. But she had no voice, and it did not end. Instead, she felt something other than the hands, the fingers. She felt something solid brush over one breast, then the other. Something as cold as steel. Something with a razor-sharp edge. She realized suddenly that it was a blade. The blade of a knife held by one of the hands that had been groping her a moment before. The sharp edge brushed lightly up and down one of her erect nipples, and then so smoothly that for a moment she did not even realize it. The knife began to cut, to slice back and forth, back and forth. Laura could feel the blade into her flesh, feel it move from side to side beneath her nipple, which she knew must be peeling away. She opened her eyes, opened them wide, so wide that it hurt the muscles around them, but she could not see. And then she realized that it was not a dream at all, and that she was blind. She tried to scream. Could not find her voice, then could only sigh, only whisper, only murmur, and then with all the strength she possessed, she screamed at the top of her lungs, screamed her throat ragged, screamed until she had no breath left in her. Then she gasped for air and screamed again, this time crying, "It's cutting me! I'm blind!" Everyone around her awoke immediately, including Peter, who awoke crying. And Chris ran stumblingly across the hall and into the living room. Laura sat up, throwing aside her sheet and blanket, and clutching at her breasts, screaming again and again, her eyes wide. Chris flicked on the light and looked directly into Laura's eyes. It was obvious to him immediately that she was seeing nothing, that she was blind. Then it ended as abruptly as it began. Laura fell back on her pillow and relaxed, groaning as she rubbed her eyes a moment, then looked at all the concerned faces that hovered over her. Chris knelt at her side after grabbing the tape recorder, and John joined him.
"Tell us what happened," Chris said breathlessly.
She did, slowly and with a lot of stuttering and stammering. When she was done, the two investigators looked at one another.
"They're attacking the eyes,"
Chris whispered.
"That means we'll have to act fast,"
John responded quietly.
"They're angry."
Late one night, while everyone else tried to sleep on the mattresses in the living room, Chris and John sat up at the dining room table. Chris dozed, his head resting on his folded arms, while John browsed distractedly through that day's paper. He was scanning the comics when he first heard the sound. Footsteps. Coming slowly up the stairs. John let the paper fall to the table, reached over and shook Chris's arm. He didn't budge. He shook it harder and hissed.
"Chris, wake up!"
He stopped, suddenly realizing what was happening. He'd experienced it before. Sometimes a demonic presence puts some of the people in a house into a deep trance while leaving others conscious to witness some sort of manifestation. John stood, got behind Chris, and lifted his shoulders from the table. When he let go, Chris dropped back onto the table like dead weight.
"Oh, God."
John breathed as the footsteps continued to ascend, now joined by a new sound, a voice, murmuring and whispering, growing closer and closer as it came up the stairs slowly. John's denim jacket was hanging on the back of the chair he'd been sitting in, and he reached down, fumbled in his pocket until he found the small flashlight he kept with him. Suddenly the room, the whole house, it seemed, grew as cold as a meat locker, and John pulled the jacket from the chair, slipping it on as he left the dining room. In the dark hall, he shone the thin beam of light toward the top of the staircase at the other end. He saw nothing yet, but could still hear the footsteps. And the voice, forming words now.
Do you know? Do you?
John crossed the hall quickly, his chest tight with fear now, his free hand in the other pocket of his jacket holding the crucifix he kept there as he prayed silently. He shone the light into the living room, sweeping it over the still forms on the floor.
"Anybody awake?"
he asked, his voice cracking. Louder, he said,
"Anybody hear me?
Do you know what they did?"
the voice asked. Louder now, the words clear. It was neither male nor female, and it gurgled wetly. John smelled something unpleasant, something rotten. When he spoke again, he saw his breath form a cloud before his face.
"Come on, wake up! Somebody, wake up!"
No one moved. No one even stirred.
"Oh, God,"
John murmured as he backed out of the living room, knowing that they weren't going to wake up, that they couldn't. Once in the hall again, he turned slowly to his right, removing the crucifix from his pocket as the slow footsteps reached the top of the stairs. He turned the light down the hall and sucked in a ragged gasp that caught in his constricted throat. The beam landed on bare flesh, mottled with white and purple. It was loose, flabby flesh that jiggled and swayed as the thing that stood at the top of the stairs with its back to John slowly began to turn. For a long moment, John could not move, could only stare with his jaw slack and his eyes gaping, and his arms and legs trembling. It was a woman. She was stooped and pear-shaped, with tube-like breasts, nipples laced with stretch marks and spread thinly over the entire rounded end of each of the breasts, which dangled back and forth over her broad, jiggly belly as she hobbled forward slowly down the hall toward John. Her belly almost hung over the patch of mangy pubic hair between her fat, lumpy thighs. Her long hair, dark with gray streaks, hung in greasy, matted strings. Her fingernails and toenails were thick, black chunks that curled downward over her fingers and toes, and her eyes rolled loosely in their sockets. The beam from John's flashlight moved jerkily over flesh spotted with large clots of bruise-like purple. She had no teeth, and her lips pulled back over her gums as she spoke.
"Do you know what they did to us down there? Do you know?"
He'd been holding his breath, but now began to breathe again and held up the cross, saying weakly, his breath puffing in the dark,
"Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women."
"What am I doing?" he wondered silently. "I've done this before. I know what I'm supposed to be doing."
"Do you know what they did to our bodies?"
the corpse rasped, coming closer and closer, the stench of rotting flesh growing more overwhelming as it neared.
"Do you know the things they did to us?"
He stiffened his arm, holding the cross out farther as he shouted,
"In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave this place and go back to the place from which you've come."
"And do you know what else?"
it asked, ignoring his words as the loose, flabby lips spread into a broad grin, bearing pink and purple gums in a waggling tongue.
"Do you know what else? We loved it,"
the corpse hissed, beginning to laugh, a wet, cackling laugh.
"We loved the groping and the fucking and the sucking."
"In the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave this place!"
and the tonguing, and the fingering, and the humping.
And go back to the place from which you've come.
Do you hear me, you godless cock-sucking asshole? We loved it.
And suddenly the corpse stopped hobbling and began to rush down the hall impossibly quickly, but now suddenly, as if John had blinked and missed the transformation, it was no longer a corpse. It had sprouted wings, great leathery bat-like wings, edged with tufts of gray fur, and the head was no longer that of a long-dead woman, but was reptilian and pointed, with no lips, and with tiny glistening eyes. It thrust itself toward him rapidly as the body, now covered with scaled, wrinkled skin that hung in loose, jiggling folds and sporting an enormous, fat erection that tapered to a cone-like point, swayed back and forth, running on its clawed, reptilian feet. John screamed so loudly that he felt as if his eyes might pop from their sockets.
In the name of—
But he was unable to get any further, because the creature was on him and he felt its hot, sickening breath on his face as its powerful arms turned him around and threw him to the floor face down. And then it was on top of him, its foul-smelling wings embracing him from behind like the arms of a lover. John began to scream. Then he lost consciousness. When he awoke later, he had no idea how much later. He was still lying on the cold wood floor of the hall. He began to crawl toward the dining room immediately, trying to call out but unable to do a little more than murmur. His flashlight was still on the floor, its narrow beam shining over the wood. Chris darted out of the dining room.
John, what happened?
It was a while before John could tell him. A single night did not pass without eventually erupting into screams. Sometimes one scream, sometimes more at the same time. At least once, but usually more often. No one slept an entire night through, and the researchers hardly slept at all, a fact that was made obvious by their puffy, bloodshot eyes and their sometimes slurred speech and sluggish movements. Ed and Lorraine came by almost every day and prayed with them. But they could tell that the demonic force in the house was gaining strength, and that it wouldn't be long before they could do nothing to stop it. They made frequent calls to Father George to see how long the Snedekers would have to wait before the church took some action, and each time Father George told them the same thing.
I'm doing the very best I can.
What he didn't tell them was that, since their visit to the Snedekers' house, both he and Father Gary had been the victims of a number of attacks similar to those going on in the house every day and night. But he really was doing his best to get the church's permission to conduct an exorcism in the Snedeker home. In fact, everyone continued to do their best. But the assaults continued. Day after day, night after night, the voices and the smells. Objects moving around by themselves, physical attacks, the stinging and prodding and touching, the sexual attacks, until everyone in the house began to think they were losing their minds. And then finally, help came. 27. Father Nolan. Permission for an exorcism was finally granted by the Catholic Church, and a priest experienced in performing the ancient ritual was chosen for the job. Father Sean Nolan was a broad-shouldered, muscular man who stood 6 feet 3 inches tall. He maintained the exact same physical fitness regimen he had followed when he was in the Marine Corps. When he was asked to perform the exorcism of the Snedeker's home, Father Nolan immediately began a week-long preparation, training of sorts, that consisted of 3 days of constant private prayer, followed by 3 more days of fasting and study. When he did eat, he stuck mostly to fruits and vegetables and increased his exercise program. He knew that his physical, mental, and, most important, his spiritual resources would be needed for the coming battle, because that was exactly what it would be, a vicious, all-out battle. He'd been through several exorcisms before this one, and was well aware of the danger to an exorcist during a confrontation with pure, naked evil. He knew the risks he was taking. Profane and humiliating assault, and a hideous death. But he also knew that only the Lord could save him, if his mind was clear and his faith in God was strong. So he worked hard to prepare, using prayer the way an athlete might use exercise, using Bible study the way a boxer might use weights, because Father Nolan knew that once the exorcism began, it could not be called off, no matter how much he might want it to stop. Meanwhile, as the day of the exorcism drew nearer, Alan Carmen Snedeker began to grow concerned. Very early one morning, just before dawn, after both of them had awakened and were unable to go to sleep, they sat at the dining room table facing one another over tea. The children and Laura were still asleep, as was John. Chris was in the bathroom taking a shower.
"Do you really think it's going to do any good?"
Al whispered groggily.
"Well, guess we don't have much choice, do we?"
"Yeah, but what about the other things? The blessings, the mass? It just seemed to make it angrier. What's an exorcism going to do?"
"If it gets worse, I guess we could always move."
"With what? How? We can't afford to move," he hissed. "We're barely getting by now, Carmen. We're still suffering from all those medical bills. If our insurance had been better, yeah, sure, we could probably move now, but our insurance stinks. We're still paying off most of those damned bills."
"Please, Al, don't talk that way. It had to be done. Poor Stephen was... he didn't get cancer on purpose, you know."
Al bowed his head and sighed.
"Yeah, I know. Damn it. Poor kid. Hope he's doing okay."
They had visited him regularly at first, calling him often, but after a while he started refusing their calls. Then he said he didn't want to see them, and one of the doctors told them it might be best if they stayed away for a little while. Stephen was going through some intensive therapy, he explained, and that could be very taxing, but extremely beneficial.
"We could always call it off," Carmen said. "The exorcism, I mean."
"Oh, yeah, and how would that look? Like we were a bunch of fakes who'd changed their minds under pressure, that's how it would look. No, we'll go through with it."
"And if things get worse afterward?"
"Well," he shrugged, "I guess we'll just have to deal with that if it happens, huh?"
Before the day of the exorcism, Father Nolan asked Al and Carmen to remove Michael and Stephanie and Peter from the house so that when he arrived, only Al and Carmen, Laura, Ed and Lorraine, and the two remaining researchers, Chris and John, were there to meet him. Father Nolan came to the house wearing street clothes, a pair of black slacks, a powder blue shirt, and a gray sport coat, and carried a small black suitcase, only slightly larger than a briefcase, as he headed up the walk toward the door. It was just a little after noon on a warm, bright, and sunny day, but when Father Nolan walked into the house, winter surrounded him. It was much colder than a house should have been in the summer. It was darker in there than it should have been, too, in spite of the fact that the drapes were open and the blinds were up. There was a charge in the air, far worse than static electricity, a malignant energy that made every inch of Father Nolan's body tingle sickeningly. He knew immediately that he was dealing with something much worse and much stronger than he'd anticipated, something that had been in this place far too long and had managed to take root, like an ugly, strangling vine.
"We're not sure what you need us to do, Father," Carmen said as they stood in the hall, "but we're willing to do whatever you ask."
"That's very kind of you," Father Nolan said, giving her a warm smile as he touched her arm. "For one thing, we need a sort of makeshift altar."
"Will a coffee table do?"
"It will do perfectly. For another thing, I think everyone present who is of the Catholic faith should confess their sins and be given absolution."
"I think everyone here is Catholic."
"Then that's fine. I'm going to change my clothes, then we'll begin."
Father, if you don't mind my asking, why did you come like this?"
"Well, I thought it would be better for you. You've had enough priests come to your house lately, and this way your neighbors won't ask a lot of embarrassing questions."
It had not even occurred to Carmen, but she smiled appreciatively and said,
"Thank you."
"Where can I change my clothes?"
She directed him to the master bedroom at the end of the hall, where he closed the door behind him. When Father Nolan came out of the bedroom, he was wearing a white robe and a purple collar. The altar was set up on the coffee table in the living room, which still had mattresses spread over the floor. Private confessions were made to Father Nolan by each person present, and absolution was given. Once the confessions were made, Father Nolan blessed the house for the third time. Then everyone gathered in front of the makeshift altar in the living room.
"First," Father Nolan said, "I would like to say a mass to cleanse us all, and the house as well."
Everyone agreed immediately, and a few moments later Father Nolan began the mass. Once again, as during the previous mass, those present began to have silent struggles with the presence in the house. Carmen began to feel a cold hand lightly moving over her body, fingers probing and prodding in intimate places. She squirmed and shifted her weight from one foot to another, but remained focused on the mass and fought to ignore it. A finger began to poke Laura in the eyes, first in the left, then the right, again and again. Then both eyes at once, until she finally closed them tightly and bowed her head in what appeared to be an act of reverence rather than self-protection. Al began to hear a voice. It did not come from anywhere around him, but from inside him, in his head. It was, however, just as loud and just as clear as if the speaker were growling angrily in his face.
"What fucking good do you think this will do, Alan? You think this god will help you now? Why, he hasn't helped you before this, has he? Well, has he?"
Al took a deep breath, locked his eyes on Father Nolan, and after a while the voice went away. But Al's discomfort did not. Ed Warren began to experience a curious feeling in his chest. It came and went, but it was a familiar one. It was a tight, constricting feeling, not unlike what he'd felt in 1985 when he'd suffered from a heart attack. Lorraine was experiencing white flashes behind her eyes, as if there were a sluggish strobe light inside her head. Within each of those bright white flashes was a picture, a naked corpse on a table, rough hands on bluish-white breasts, a living male body atop the corpse, face locked in wide-mouthed passion. And deep in Lorraine's head, she heard the sound of distant, echoing laughter. Cruel, mocking laughter. And then the mass was over. Father Nolan faced them and sighed, smiling.
"Now," he said, "I would like to begin the exorcism. But first, I'd like to say a few things."
Everyone was attentive. The demonic harassment had stopped.
"First of all," Father Nolan said, "this may go on for some time, for hours, perhaps, and I want to assure you," he chuckled, "no one's head is going to spin around. If you saw that movie, I know what you must be thinking. This may not be easy. We might very well meet with some retaliation, but it won't be like that. It could, however, get unpleasant. It could get rough. I just want you to be prepared."
"How long did you say it could take?"
Carmen asked timidly.
"Hours. It could take hours. It just depends on what happens."
Everyone nodded slightly.
"So," Father Nolan said quietly, "are you ready to begin?"
"Yes,"
Al and Carmen said simultaneously. Then Carmen added,
"Please."
28. The Exorcism. The moment the exorcism began, Ed Warren noticed a violation of protocol that made him realize that the situation was even more serious than he had suspected. Even more than that, it made him realize that the church knew how serious it was, and that they had sent someone who would act accordingly. The ritual being used by Father Nolan was the Rituale Romanus, the Roman exorcism ritual, which was performed in Latin and which, in 42 years of research in psychic and supernatural phenomena, Ed had never, ever seen a priest use in the exorcism of a house. It was often used for the exorcism of a person of the Catholic faith, whom the church had decided was, indeed, possessed by a demon, but it was never used to exorcise a house. As the exorcism went on, Ed began to feel once again the constriction in his chest that he'd felt during the Mass. His heart began to pound against his ribs so hard that he could feel it in his throat. He took a deep breath and tried to ignore the sensation as the exorcism continued. Carmen began to feel the hand again, but this time it was much rougher than before. Her exhaustion was overwhelming. She thought she might not win this battle after all. This time, Laura felt more than just a finger poking her eyes. This time it was poking her all over her body, poking mercilessly, poking everywhere, poking hard. But she knew why. If she were to cry out, she would bring the exorcism to a screeching halt, and she knew she did not want to do that. So she simply prayed silently and stiffened her back, determined not to pay attention to the things that were being done to her. The voice that had growled inside Al's head during the Mass returned during the exorcism. It returned with a vengeance, screaming this time, saying,
"You stupid son of a bitch, asshole! You think this'll do something, you spineless fucking weakling? You think this'll help you, cocksucking wimp, you ass-licking weakling?"
He closed his eyes for a moment, telling himself, "If you just ignore it, it'll go away, and this will all be over." The exorcism continued. Knick-knacks on shelves and cabinets began to rattle. Pictures hanging on the wall began to tremble, their frames clattering against the wall. 4 hours into the exorcism, Ed Warren's left arm began to ache. It began to throb as his chest grew tighter and tighter. Beads of sweat began to break out on his forehead and upper lip, and trickled slowly down his face as his breath gradually grew short, and his heartbeat began to pound in his head. Ed grabbed Lorraine's hand, clutched it tightly, and leaned toward her, whispering in her ear,
"I can't believe what's happening to me."
She felt the trembling in his hand, which was very uncharacteristic for Ed, and when she saw the sweat pouring down his face, she became very concerned.
"What is it?"
she whispered, turning to him, trying hard not to interrupt the ceremony. Ed put a hand to his chest.
"I think it's my heart,"
he whispered as the pain in his arm increased and his chest felt as if a steel band were tightening around it, pulling tighter and tighter.
"I'm gonna have to get out of here,"
Ed wheezed, squeezing Lorraine's hand even tighter as he tried to catch his breath. She began to lead him from the living room to the hallway, but something happened that brought them to a sudden halt. The entire house tilted so that Ed and Lorraine were suddenly climbing up the floor rather than walking across it. Everyone in the room cried out, suddenly clutching one another for balance. Father Nolan leaned down and gripped the table, but did not miss a beat. He continued the ritual, his voice louder than before, his eyes wider and his jaw set firmly with determination. Lorraine was not deterred by what she knew to be nothing more than a very convincing illusion, and she continued to lead Ed out of the room, across the hall and into the dining room, where he dropped heavily into a chair, folded his arms on the tabletop, and lowered his head weakly. Father Nolan continued as the others regained their balance when the house seemed to level out. But it was not through with them. As the ritual went on, what felt like waves moved fluidly through the floor, making all of them stumble again and again. Tendrils of smoke rose from the carpet, tendrils that stretched upward like arms and formed hands at the ends, groping, clawing hands, hands that clutched at their legs as they rose, hands that could feel, hands with sharp claws that scraped over their clothes, trying to slice through, trying to get to their skin, to slice through their flesh as well. And then as suddenly as they had come, they were gone. The ritual continued. Perspiration was visible on Father Nolan's face, and his hands were beginning to tremble. The strain showed in his eyes and on his unsteady lips. Suddenly voices began to fill the room, low, hoarse, and guttural voices that were heard by them all and that began to close in on them from every direction. Wet, gurgling voices that brought with them a smell, a vile, hideous stench, the reek of rotting, decaying flesh.
"We loved it. The fucking and the sucking.
All that groping and fondling.
It was wonderful."
Then they began to appear, oozing out of the walls and through the furniture, like fluid in the shape of human bodies, both male and female, naked and bruised, their bodies puffy and mottled with white and blue and purple. Their eyes rolled back in their heads so that only glaring whites were visible, some with their arms swaying limply at their sides as they moved in, others with an arm or both arms outstretched as they shuffled, the voices continuing.
No god that can stop it. Don't want it to stop. Enjoyed it. All of it. All that licking on our skin. All that feeling and touching. Fucking and sucking. Groping and licking.
Father Nolan raised his voice to a near shout, standing straighter than before, his voice growing even louder as he ended the ritual at a fever pitch, shouting the Latin words hoarsely. They were gone. The horrible stench had left the room. Father Nolan was dripping with sweat. He faced those in the room for a long moment, trying to catch his breath. Although he was in top physical condition, he looked as though he had been brought to the very precipice of his endurance. He turned from the makeshift altar, left the room, and went into the dining room, holding a vial of holy water in one hand. Father Nolan stood over Ed Warren, looking down at him with great concern.
"How is he?"
he asked Lorraine, who sat beside Ed with her arm around his shoulders.
"Well, I'm not really sure," she whispered hoarsely. "He's had a heart attack before, you know. If he doesn't come out of this soon, we're going to have to call an ambulance."
Father Nolan sprinkled Ed with holy water, waved his hand through the air in the shape of the cross, and murmured something in Latin. Then he leaned forward and asked quietly,
"Are you all right, Ed?"
Ed lifted his head from the coffee table and coughed.
"Yeah, I think so."
"Good. So am I."
He stood and said very loudly,
"By the power of Jesus Christ, we are both all right."
Almost as if a heavy blanket had suddenly been lifted from the house, the feeling of oppression, the dark and smothering atmosphere that had permeated the house for so long was, in that moment, gone. It was so noticeable that those still standing in the living room gasped with shock when they felt the change. The house seemed brighter, as if the sun, for the first time in a long while, was finally able to penetrate the window panes and illuminate the inside of the house. Ed Warren pushed his chair away from the dining room table and stood slowly, carefully, with Lorraine's arm still around his broad shoulders. He turned to Father Nolan, gave him a weak smile, and said,
"I think it worked, Father. I think it worked."
29. A few months later. They were moving, finally. Laura and Mary had gone back to Alabama to be with their mother. Stephen was out of the hospital, but had refused to come back to the house. He was staying with his aunt until they were moved out. Even then, he guaranteed nothing. He was still very cautious with them. And once they'd moved out, they would have to take their relationship from there and try to patch up all the holes. The important thing at the moment was that they were, finally and at last, moving out of the house in which their lives had been such a hell. Epilogue. The Snedekers did leave the house on Meridian and never went back. In fact, merely driving close by made their skin crawl and their palms sweat. They moved to another house in another Connecticut town, where they went about the slow process of recovering from their ordeal. They still live in Connecticut as of this writing. And as of this writing, the white, two-level colonial still stands on Meridian, as does the twisted, dancing, corpse-like tree in the front yard. Tenants have come and gone since the Snedekers left, and the house is currently occupied. Not long after leaving, the Snedekers heard whispers about the new tenants having some strange experiences in the house. They heard that the new tenants were asking questions about the previous occupants, curious to learn if they knew anything about what was happening there. Carmen felt sorry for them. She feared for them, prayed for them. One evening, she timidly suggested to Al that they contact the occupants of their former house and try to help them. Al turned to her suddenly and lost some of the color in his face as his eyes widened.
"Are you kidding?"
he asked, barely able to speak in a whisper.
I don't even want to talk to anybody who lives in that house. Not even over the phone. If they don't like it there, they'll leave."
"But what if they're like us?" Carmen asked. "What if they can't?
What if they don't have any choice?
He looked away from her and turned to the television.
Then we'll just have to pray for them, I guess.
But Al was right. The new occupants of the house did leave. They were, however, followed by another family, and another, and still another. The end. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of In a Dark Place by Ed and Lorraine Warren, Carmen Reed, and Al Snedeker with Ray Garten. Read for you by Todd Haberkorn. Produced by David Zindel. Text copyright 1992 by Ray Garten, Carmen Reed, Al Snedeker, Ed Warren, and Lorraine Warren. Production copyright 2016, Gray Malkin Media. All rights reserved.